Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. There's a self-help book that came out a while back called Eat the Frog. I don't know where it came from since I never read this type of literature, not that there's anything wrong with it. The premise is you get the tough stuff out of the way first and the rest is easy. So I guess there are a few things more difficult than eating a frog. Well, last week it was art and this time it's math, two of my weaker subjects when it comes to intelligent conversation. But now I've eaten the frog, so it's all cake and ice cream from here on in. I've been a long-time admirer of the work of Professor Andrew Zimbalist, who writes about baseball numbers, both financial and sabermetric. His latest book, The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball, was co-authored with Benjamin Baumer. Zimbalist, whose work on the game includes May the Best Team Win, Baseball Economics and Public Policy, and In the Interests of Baseball, Governing the National Pastime, we'll discuss his work at the Bergoglio Baseball Clubhouse on Tuesday, January 28th at 7 p.m. In the meantime, he did his best to add to my education. Here are the results. Good morning, Andrew Zimbalist.
Good morning.
So, you start off the book right away by taking a whack at Moneyball. What is your problem with Moneyball?
I don't have a personal emotional problem with Moneyball, but I think that it is a very inaccurate representation of the history and application of sabermetrics in baseball. And I think that it butchers the facts in order to tell a compelling story. At the end of the day, Lewis signals the emergence of sabermetrics in the front office of the Oakland A's, and that's an important observation, and I think the book is important historically because it clearly catalyzes the movement of the entire industry towards the adoption of sabermetrics. So he tells a good story. I think the underlying message is accurate, but he butchers the facts in getting there, and he misrepresents baseball and sabermetric history.
So let's talk about sabermetrics per se for those of us like me who are literate, more or less with the statistical versus the historical aspects of the game. What is sabermetrics?
So sabermetrics is a term that was coined by Bill James, and it's based on the Society for American Baseball Research, SABR. James added an E between the B and the R for saber, and then added metrics. And what it is the application of statistical analysis in order to better appraise the game. Most often it's applied to players, player performance, but it can also be applied to managerial strategic decision making. It can be applied to baseball's front offices. So it's broadly the use of statistical analytics to understand baseball.
So this is basically for lack of a better word, business purposes in looking at your employee performances and how you use your employees using baseball players as employees. Why is this important to fans so much?
Well, it's a mischaracterization to say it's for business purposes only. It's something that was developed by fans. Bill James was a fan of baseball, and other early practitioners were fans of baseball. They were not in the baseball industry. They were not part of the establishment. And they started communicating with each other, first through newsletters and then through the internet, to try to understand player performance. And it was fed by the emergence of fantasy league baseball activity, people who were trading players in their fantasy leagues and wanted to have greater insight into which players would be best on their team, started developing new metrics. And some of these metrics go back to observations that were made by Henry Chadwick, who was the inventor of the box score back in the 1870s and 1880s. But he didn't call them what they're called today, and they kind of slipped away from the baseball lexicon for decades and decades. But various people over the decades have said things like, why do we use batting average? That's like adding up your wealth by counting the number of coins in your pocket and ignoring the difference between pennies and nickels and dimes and quarters. Why do we ignore batting average? Overlooks the difference between singles and doubles and triples and home runs. Why do we do that? And it also happens to eliminate walks. It doesn't consider walks. So, you know, sabermetricians sort of looked at this and said, well, let's develop some new statistics that take advantage of the nuances of difference that exist in the game. So that was happening on the hitting side. They developed new measurements for pitchers and new measurements for fielders. All of them made eminent sense, and you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to understand any of it. And these developments were flourishing in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. And again, it's not really till around the year 2000, around the turn of the century, that it begins to be adopted in a massive way within the industry and to begin to be applied for business purposes. So it's still very much a tool that fans have used. And interestingly, statistical analytics are also being used in all of the other sports now. But in the other sports, the development or the introduction of statistical analytics into the industry was not preceded by decades of fans using these new methods. Basically, they just came right into the industry. So in baseball, you had a maturation of the analysis that was in the public sphere for a long time. And in the other industries, it was almost immediately assimilated or absorbed for business purposes.
So would you say this is a case of the tail wagging the dog? The fans got into this first, and then it was picked up by baseball itself?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Now, one of the things you talk about is the discrepancy in some of the statistics, particularly WAR, wins above replacement. And it's coming from different outlets, all fighting for statistical supremacy.
Yeah.
So you can understand the confusion that the fans who are like, I am not a fantasy baseball practitioner, so a lot of this stuff is very foreign to me. So you can understand where some fans are coming from when they say all these numbers and all these statistics. Not that they're ruining the game, but they're detracting from the enjoyment of the game as played on the field, historically speaking.
Oh, I'm not sure that I understand that position. I don't see why it would detract from the enjoyment of the game. Nobody has to do a calculation of WAR, W-A-R, wins above replacement. Nobody has to do that when they watch a baseball game, and it's something that's not usually talked about by broadcasters. It's sometimes talked about in sports talk shows by hosts who don't know what they're talking about. The problem with WAR is that once sabermetrics became a business tool, and once the teams begin to pay for the purported sabermetric insights that are going to make their outfit perform better or make it more profitable, then people try to sell the goods of sabermetrics. You get a lot of charlatans out there. But the problem with WAR is not a problem with charlatans. The problem with WAR is that you have different outfits like Baseball Prospectus and like Fangraphs that are developing proprietary methods that they want to sell to the teams. And so they don't. They put out this idea of WAR. That's a measurement basically of the productivity of players. How much is an individual player worth? How many games is that player worth to his team above what's called a replacement player? They put this notion out there, and they don't tell us how they get there. They don't tell us what's the formula that underlies WAR. Well, it turns out that they have things in there like UZR, which is a measurement of defensive performance, and they don't tell us really the details of UZR either. And measuring something like UZR, which is defensive performance, and the idea there is that you don't only want to look at the fielder's fielding percentage, but you want to look at how much ground the fielder covers, because whether or not the fielder can get to the ball is also important not just whether if he gets to the ball he can field it and make an accurate throw. But it turns out it's enormously complicated to measure something like that. And they don't tell you how they're measuring UZR, and they don't tell you the specifics of the components of war. And so if you go deeper into their records, you can find for individual players that one of the war statistics will have a very high. They might come. Let's take for instance the player David Wright for the Mets. He has a WAR that is very similar between the three different outfits. The total WAR, it's not identical. It's quite similar between the three outfits that do it, but the components are completely different. So it's almost random that they ended up with the same number. And then you get on the defensive side, you get them saying that in 1 year Derek Jeter has the lowest rating of all shortstops, and then miraculously in the next year he has the highest rating of all shortstops, and you get that kind of variability in these measurements. And the only thing that can make you believe is that there's something spurious going on. And so the problem is that there's, as it's become commercialized, there's this mystery that enshrouds a lot of these statistics, and I think it undermines the legitimacy and the value of the statistics.
Now you mentioned in the book the problems of Philly percentage is that the errors are judged by an official scorer who may or may not be biased, who is a human being. I used to work for stats, so I used to sit in the press box and record these things. And there were a couple of times when the official scorer would ask me what happened. He's sitting next to me, and
so you're to blame then,
I guess, for those few instances. Okay. But the people who chart these things on their computers, on their grids, they're human too. And I know I had trouble deciding, well, how fast is that ball going? Exactly where on the field did it land? So you still have some human element problems.
Absolutely. Oh, sure. I'm not meaning to say that because UZR is imperfect that fielding percentage is perfect. Fielding percentage, the idea of fielding percentage is introduced around the turn of the century, the last century, around 1900. And it's introduced at a time when fielders, instead of having these expensive, elaborate, long leather gloves that stick out from your fingers, basically fielders in those days were wearing something that's very similar to what a golfer wears today. And it was a real question. What if somebody hits a three hop ground ball to you at shortstop, will you be able to catch it and then make the throw to first? And so there was a substantial variability in fielding percentages from one player to the next. It was a big deal if you could catch the ball on three hops or a line drive or a pop up that was hit to you. That was a big deal. That was important. These days, it's pretty rare that a fielder will drop the ground ball. What's more variable across fielders is what kind of a jump do they get when the ball leaves the bat, and how fast can they move to the spot, and can they have the appropriate balance when they get to that spot to pick up the ball and turn and throw it successfully to the base. So it's important to try to measure those things. It's just that the measurements, in fact, at this point are very, very imperfect, and it becomes more problematic when they don't tell you how it is that they're making the measurements.
So can you accurately compare or fairly compare a shortstop who played in the 40s with a shortstop playing today? I don't know who, let's say, I don't know offhand Lou Boudreau's fielding statistics. I don't know if he was considered a great fielder at shortstop,
right.
But compare him to someone, a top shortstop today. Can you, is there a way to fairly compare them?
I don't think there is. And what you I think want to do when you assess baseball players is assess them relative to their peers. That's the only fair way to judge somebody. And not only is the issue that the gloves are different, but the speed of the bat is different, the condition of the infields is different, and how much travel they have to do is different, and so on and so forth.
But you have all these books that talk about the greatest players of all time, and they are comparing them, they are ranking them, going back to the pre-1900 players.
Right.
So is that fair that they're doing it that way?
Well, I think it depends on how much subtlety there is in the analysis and how many qualifications they use. I think it's something interesting for baseball fans to contemplate, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be contemplated. But if the analyst or the writer is claiming that he or she has some foolproof, fully accurate method of making the comparison, I think that's very misleading.
Tell me a little bit how personal technology has a hand in all this today with the advent of, you discuss it a little bit in the book.
I'm not sure
like
what
the,
you mean.
The, you know, with the prominence of tablets and smartphones, and you know, does that make things easier, difficult?
So one of the things that's interesting and is part of the mischaracterization of what's going on that happens in the book and the movie Moneyball, one of the things that's interesting is that today's player evaluator is somebody who invariably uses both visual and quantitative evidence. That is to say, they watch with their eyes either the live performance or they watch videos, and they use that as a way to assess how good a player is. And that same person will look at the numbers. They'll use some of the new sabermetric categories or metrics, and they combine sabermetrics with the visual stuff. So one of the things that happens today is that you have a scout, which somebody is still called a scout. They're standing behind the batter's cage during a game or at a practice, and they have a tablet with them. And they might have a jug gun in another hand, or they might be standing next to somebody with a jug gun who's measuring the speed of pitches and the speed of the muzzle speed off of the bat. And so they're at the same time that they are watching with their eyes and making observations and making notes about that, they're incorporating in those notes some statistical evidence, and it all becomes part of the same analytical package. And the presence of the use of the iPhone and iPads and so on and so forth enables this communication to happen in a much more comprehensive way and in a much more rapid way than would have been possible.
But you have that. I guess it won't go on that much longer as the older generation of scouts moves on. but there are several movies. You know, Moneyball is one. Trouble with the Curve is another.
Yes.
Million Dollar Arm that's coming out, where you have the battle between the old-fashioned scouts who see with their heart, so to speak, and the statisticians, who everything is in cold hard numbers. So that always makes for
that dichotomy
good versus evil type type situation, but it has become a trope among baseball movies these days.
Exactly. Well, so Trouble with the Curve does the opposite thing that Moneyball does. Moneyball makes the scouts out to be bumbling idiots, and the sabermetricians out to be brilliant, insightful evaluators, and Trouble with the Curve turns the tables on that and says that the scouts are the brilliant ones and the sabermetricians are just geeks who don't know what they're talking about. And so, yeah, it creates this dichotomy, it creates this tension, and the either the reader or the viewer is supposed to be enthralled by the tension there. But it's not the reality, and it was never the reality, If you talk to the people who were at the A's in the late 1990s and the early 2000s in the front office, like Di Podesta, they say no. You know, sure, they had disagreements, but over time they learned to respect each other and they worked together, and that in fact is the way the industry has evolved.
And we've been talking with Andrew Zimbalist, co-author with Benjamin Baumer of The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball. Andrew will be appearing at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in Manhattan on Tuesday, the 28th at 7 p.m. I highly recommend it. It's a wonderful venue to go and meet Andrew and talk about these sabermetric revolutions. Andrew, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Andrew Zimbalist. Again, he'll be appearing Tuesday, January 28th at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 7 p.m. For further information, visit bergino.com. That wraps up another fascinating podcast with a wonderful guest. Not sure who we're going to be having on in the near future. I really wanted to get this out quick in time for his appearance next Tuesday. But I'm sure Whoever we have on will be as fascinating as everyone we've had on in the past. And remember, for news about baseball books and whatnot, visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com. And that was Kevin Baker talking about his work on Reggie Jackson's latest memoir, Becoming Mr. October. Well, thanks for listening. Tune in again soon. We hope to be doing these more often. And don't forget, it's holiday time, and nothing makes a better baseball book gift than 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die, available at Amazon.com and hopefully your local bookstore. Thanks again, everybody. See you soon.